I mean, you're framing that question in like an absurdly obnoxious way.
So Venezuela is clearly not at war with the US, and yet the act being invoked in order to deport these people without due process relies on the US being at war with that country.
Largely, I'm very against executive actions. I would say very vocal about that for many, many years. Trump came in, did a bunch of executive actions as it pertained to the border.
What's something that you agree with on the left side, Phipps? This is Critical Edge. Today we're here with Dave Rubin, host of the eponymous Rubin Report and one of America's foremost commentators on the right. Dave, welcome.
Good to be with you guys. Let's see if I'm still on the right at the end of this thing. Anything could happen, you know?
Yeah, we'll see. I think we're more of a left-leaning podcast, but we're open to, you know, as Dave Crowder would say, our minds being changed. Stephen Crowder, rather. Okay, Dave, what was the last time you changed your mind in a significant way?
Ooh, the last time I changed my mind in a significant way. Well, if we're talking politics, I mean, my political evolution from, you know, being a progressive back in when I started doing the original Rubin Report back in 2013, which 12 years ago, it seems like many lifetimes ago, the internet makes everything faster. You know, I evolved on an awful lot of things. I changed my mind on an awful lot of things. I would say the thing that I sort of most obviously change on that I started talking about a lot that kind of, I think, helped wake up a lot of people was what we now all call wokeness, which I really realized, I would say early on from an American perspective, that, you know, putting group identity over individual identity is probably the most dangerous thing that you can do at a political level, especially in a multicultural Western society like you guys live in, like I live in, like I think most liberal democracies aspire to be. Once you start saying to people your skin color or your religion or your sexuality or your genitals, like that's the stuff that matters as opposed to what you say and think, it really basically screws up everything else. And that's kind of why we're all of our societies are in the positions that we're in at the moment. So I did buy into that. It's hard for me to believe that now, but you know, you can watch videos of mine 2012, 2013, 2014, when I did buy into identity politics to a certain extent. I would say also economics, I've shifted. You know, I was a Bernie supporter back in, I mean, even as late as 2015, if I'm not mistaken, there are videos saying that I supported Bernie. And now I want nothing to do with, you know, sort of more socialist, big government, top-down economics. And I'm definitely more on the libertarian economic side. I don't know that those are like change of mind things as much as sort of just evolution of thought type of things. But I like when people change their mind. I mean, even lately on my show, we've had a couple, there's a lot of people in America right now who are kind of, you could look at Tulsi Gabbard or Bobby Kennedy, that are kind of coming around who've been sort of moderate liberals, who I would say now are just kind of on the more liberal side of the conservative side of things, you could say. And I love talking to people who are kind of just thinking about things a little bit differently, even if they think different things than I do, obviously.
Okay, so hopefully we can kind of get into that discussion about where our opinions may differ and hopefully maybe align a little bit as well. In terms of groupthink, which you mentioned, would you agree that groupthink on the left is not that different from maybe your position, which is quite a contrarian right-wing echo chamber?
Well, I don't know that I agree with the premise of the question. How do you mean groupthink echo chamber?
Well, what I mean by that is, do you think that the kind of leftist idea that everyone thinks in the same way differs from kind of maybe the way that you might think or operate? Just reason why I'm mentioning this is I listened to about 5 episodes of Rubin Report, and on many of the issues, I could predict your stance on each of the issues. And I mean that in a, not in a rude way, but that was kind of my impression when I listened to those episodes.
Sure. Well, I would say there's a fundamental, well, I think partly that you could figure it out is that I explain myself fairly well and I'm able to communicate these ideas. So if you can get to the end of the road before I even say it, I think that's probably more in some sense of like a broadcasting skill in that I'm able to calmly lay out my ideas and then I let my audience come along that journey with me. I think to get to the heart of your question, I think what you're asking really, but correct me if I'm wrong, is there more groupthink on the left than on the right? Is that another way to frame the question fairly?
I think partly, but also if you consider the way that you think as wholly independent, or rather, if you're in a position to criticize other people as thinking in, let's say, one group way, when I felt that a lot of the positions that you took were also part of a groupthink
right.
approach.
Sure. Well, can maybe give me an example of that and it would be easier for you to...
For example, there was kind of the Signalgate drama that's recently kind of been happening in America. And I felt like your take that, you know, if Biden had done it, it would have been terrible. But if Trump does it, it's okay because it's Trump and their administration is great. I felt like that was the sort of thing I expected.
Oh, you know, that's not what I said. I mean, that's not what I said at all. I think you're going off, maybe you're going off an appearance on Piers Morgan or something. I mean, I can explain that very easily. First off, Piers brought me on to discuss that with a couple other people on his panel show where everyone's kind of yelling over each other. And sometimes it's a little hard to understand what everyone's saying. My position on Signalgate, which, by the way, has largely just been put in the back mirror from an American perspective at this point, it ran hot for like 3 days and now it's kind of over, is that I fully admitted to Piers and to my audience as well when I was doing my daily show, I am granting Trump a little more leash on this one and the Trump administration because we just came off of 4 years where you could argue every single day, every single moment was a scandal. Joe Biden was mentally compromised and we all knew it. And the media hit it and the Democrats hit it and the administration hit it and all of the Democrat power players hit it. So every decision, we don't know that Joe Biden made any decisions. He used the auto pen to sign things. So every layer, the people that he hired, you could argue were all in some sense scandalous because he hired people, including his vice president, because of her skin color and genitals. Like the entire 4 years that we just got out of was a scandal. So what I conceded, which I actually think from an objective perspective is pretty damn honest, actually, is that I'm giving Trump a bit of a longer leash on this. I'm giving his team a little bit of a longer leash on this because in the 2 months that he's been president so far, he's hired so many competent people. They've done so much good as it pertains to the border and DOGE, and we can go into the laundry list of things that are, you know, that Ukraine and Russia are getting at least somewhat closer to a peace agreement, that there's so many good things happening that if it is in fact true that one guy on NSC, Mike Waltz, accidentally let a reporter into the group chat, I don't think that's the biggest scandal. I would be treating it probably differently than had a Biden administration done it because the entire thing was a scandal. So that's not to excuse Mike Waltz, which is exactly what I said on the show. It's up to Trump. If it actually is true that he's the guy that literally set up the group chat, accidentally let him in, and that led to all this, Trump is the one that has to decide. But was I being softer in this case on the Trump administration or on Trump himself than I would be on Biden? Absolutely, because Biden, you didn't even know who you were going after. The whole thing was a scandal.
Okay, so maybe let's take it a little bit wider in that case to sort of more general ideological things, because we obviously can't change your opinion on Signalgate. You mentioned how...
maybe you can, who knows?
Well, let me move it in any case to a wider ideological discussion, because I think it's something that's going to be maybe more relevant for a longer time when people come back and watch this video. You characterize Biden's administration as generally scandalous, and one of the terms you use to describe that often is as being a manifestation of wokeism. I think that's a fair characterization. And in your most recent book, Don't Burn This Country, you highlight some of the problems with wokeism, and I want to make sure you agree with my characterization here. One of them is the prioritization of virtue signaling, for example, through holding certain positions. Another is grouping together ideas which aren't necessarily joined, for example, on the economy versus on social questions and so on and so forth. How do those two sound to you? Is that a fair characterization?
So far, so good. Intersectionality doesn't really make sense. You know, you take oppressed groups, kind of put them all together. And just because you think something about economics doesn't mean that that should have anything to do with your sexuality. That would be the sort of easiest way to say that. Yeah.
And one of the manifestations of wokeism, of course, is cancel culture. Saying that you're not allowed to say this and you're not allowed to say this, or you shouldn't say this and you shouldn't say this. You can't disagree with us, otherwise it's a problem, right?
I don't know that that's exactly how I would describe cancel culture is when basically the entire cultural apparatus tries to destroy you for saying something slightly outside the Overton window. You could say controversial things. I say things that are thought to be controversial, even though I usually don't mean them in a controversial way. And people can push back and say mean things about you. Cancel culture, or the thing that we all saw over the last couple of years that really got put on steroids, was that people would say basic truths like boys and girls have different biological characteristics, and then they would literally get fired. So there's a difference between just saying something and getting pushback, which that's reality. You have an opinion, your friend doesn't like it, they're going to push back on you. That doesn't mean they're canceling you. Cancel culture was the cultural movement that ripped through literally from your side of the pond to our side of the pond, and made it so that people were afraid to say almost anything about anything.
Yeah, I suppose my problem and where I want to challenge you here is that I think your criticisms of cancel culture when people disagree, a societal apparatus comes against you in order to take you away from a certain group. And it's about having a bunch of ideas which are grouped together. I mean, in my opinion, the use of the word wokeism, describing somebody as woke on so many separate issues, seems to me like it's doing a similar thing where people on the right will describe somebody as woke. And it will instantly rule out discussion in the same way that canceling somebody instantly rules out discussion. And so do you see how there might be a bit of a symmetry there where you, for example, might say that something is woke and therefore try and end discussion in a certain way? And cancel culture will say, OK, well, you shouldn't say X or Y about LGBT people and therefore end a discussion. Do you see how there could be a symmetry there, despite you trying to characterize them as quite different?
Again, I don't necessarily agree with the premise, but the difference, I would say, would be is if you, first off, woke, the woke people, the lefty progressives that believe in identity politics and believe in intersectionality and all those things, they describe themselves as woke. It was their word. Are you woke or not? They wanted to be woke, meaning I should.
Right. Terms become pejorative, of course, and they take on different meanings, right?
Yeah, and it needed to become pejorative because it was ushering in all of the worst time-tested ideas. Again, talking about group identity. Just because you might be gay should not give me an indication of what tax rate you think is right or what you think foreign policy should be or border. It actually should give you a little subtext in some sense, because not all cultures are equal. And if you're gay, you'd be on the outs of some cultures. But once you say women should think this, gays should think this, Muslims should think this, and blacks should think this, you're pitting everyone against everyone. So largely, I would say, if you believe in identity politics, if you believe in intersectionality, that we can take these perceived oppressed groups and combine all their perceived oppressions, and then that's going to create some super powerful transformer, I would say that is woke. If you think that boys are girls or can turn...
But I mean, for a correction of your analysis there, you said, for example, that if you're Muslim, you should think this, if you're gay, you should think this, and so on. Isn't what you would call woke positions, what other people might call progressive positions, isn't generally the idea that based on what these groups experience, this is the right way of thinking? Now, to say that it's the right way of thinking isn't to say that you're not allowed to think otherwise or that we can't have free discussion, but that this is the opinion being put forward. Not that you should think it purely because of being part of a group, but that
I would say go to any progressive political rally or go to any progressive, say, burn down a Tesla factory rally and try to say something that they don't think that you should believe in and see how it works out for you. I was on Bill Maher's podcast a couple of years ago, and I said, Bill Maher, who's a Democrat, who has been the lefty standard bearer of liberalism in America for basically four decades. And I said something that I think really clicked in his brain. I said to him, Bill, you as a lefty and as a Democrat, and you were a Bernie supporter for a certain period of time, all this stuff, you could go to a Trump rally and not get booed. People would be, a few people might be like, there's Bill Maher. I disagree with him on this or that, but he's for free speech and he's a comic. Okay, fine. Now, Bill, try to go to an AOC rally. You would be crucified, and he got it. And he knew that that was true. So that, I would say, is the fundamental difference there. I believe that Black people can think all sorts of different things. The woke crew basically tells you there's a certain set of things Black people can believe, and if you don't believe those things, well, then we're going to treat you like Larry Elder, who the Los Angeles Times called the black face of white supremacy, or we're going to treat you like Thomas Sowell, or a long list of Black people who happen to not be
Latino. I don't think that saying... this is what the woke people think is also in some way grouping people together. Surely some people can some people can have leftist views and think, many black people, for example, believe that police brutality in America is a really big problem. But that doesn't mean that they all are part of this woke bubble.
Well, again, we use words to describe things. So if we're talking about the woke crew, I would describe the woke crew as the people who believe that identity politics reigns supreme in the hierarchy of importance. They like a top-down way of looking at the world. And if they had enough power, they could reorder things so that everyone would behave. And in essence, that's what communism is, right? Like if you can outsource all of your thinking to the machine and everyone can be below that, that somehow that will be benevolent and good. I just view that as the reverse. If what you're asking me is, has the word woke become pejorative in nature, I would say yes. And I would say that's actually a good thing because it was a horrific set of ideas that demolished meritocracy in this country. So we decided that we were going to discriminate against Asian people getting into Ivy League schools because there were too many Asian people in there and they wanted more black people in. But why should you discriminate? Past discrimination is not solved by current discrimination. So I don't have a problem with woke or any of these terms being turned against the people who are trying to upend Western values.
Okay, so nonetheless, you're still characterizing a certain unity. So I want to talk about a character who I think actually gets quite a lot of flack from both sides and who you know personally, or we might say used to know personally. We had Cenk Uygur very recently on our show. In fact, he was our last guest. We know you fell out with him and we read a little bit about that. When we spoke to him, we thought he was... a decent guy, at least on the conversation that we had. How would you characterize Cenk Uygur as a man and how he fits in to this sort of dichotomy between, let's say, woke and not woke, given that he gets flack from often both sides for his...
No, I mean, I don't have much to say about Cenk. You know, I've been gone from that company for 10 years. I don't think I've watched 3 minutes of one of their videos, even though they've done hundreds of videos about me. I've done zero videos about them. That's just the truth. He knows that I'm good for clicks. And he does, I will give him credit, which is he has a way of sort of screaming and bloviating and sweating and throwing papers around and going crazy on one show and then on another show pretending that he's calm and nice. But I don't think I need to comment on that any further.
I was on your side, I think, in the Piers Morgan debate and so far. So he just came out, started insulting you about that. Not quite.
Yeah, I mean, there's not much there. He asked me, I kept saying, tell me one thing that I purport to say that you think I don't believe. And he started screaming about gay firefighters, that I don't want there to be gay firefighters. And of course, what I was talking about is I don't want DEI in a fire department. I want you to hire the best firefighters, regardless of all of these identity politics things that we've just discussed. And then ironically, what happened 2 weeks later, we had those horrific fires in Malibu and Pacific Palisades. And we know that the Los Angeles Fire Department was largely stacked with DEI hires. So yeah, I don't really care about that guy, honestly.
Okay, so something I did find convincing from him, though, nonetheless, purely because it's based up by fact, and I think that's how discussions should go, is his discussion of corruption in America. For example, he mentioned how the Democratic Party takes almost, or has taken almost $1 billion from different PACs and from different lobbying groups. And that means that there's vested interest in the way they do politics. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, again, I don't watch him, so I don't know his opinion.
No, you have no lie. I'm asking you about whether that's a fair characterization.
Yeah, I mean, everyone knows there's lobbyists. Both sides take money from people. Politics is a pretty messy game. I don't know that Democrats even take more than the Republicans.
Do you think taking money, for example, from fossil fuel companies or taking money from, for example, big corporate interests, do you think that makes a politician corrupt, or are you going to state that there's no connection there between the policies they put forward and
well, I don't think it makes them corrupt, but I would like a much more transparent system. I don't think politicians need to be taking as much money. I think it should be much more, I think it should be as transparent as possible. And I think we're entering an age of transparency now. I think that's why I've been literally every day on my show for the last 2 months, we've been covering DOGE. Because the more that we look under the hood of how democracy in America has worked, how the swamp, whatever you want to call it, the deep state, how it has operated, in some sense, it's been a giant money laundering scheme, usually leaning towards Democrat policies. But that doesn't mean the Republicans are guiltless in that, right? Like, this is where someone like Mitch McConnell, who's been in power in the Senate from Kentucky for 50 years, he's been as much part of the machine as any Democrat, right? So there's some level of equal guilt there, although the policies usually ended up being more beneficial to the Democrats. But yeah, we should have more transparency.
Both parties take that amount of money, Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah, well, that's what I just said. There's some, I don't know if the exact amount goes to each side. Like, that's probably improbable that it's exactly penny to penny. But yeah, both sides do this. Obviously, they take money from everybody. Does that affect everyone's decisions all the time? It probably really depends on the politician. Thomas Massey, large libertarian, also from Kentucky, congressman, like, he definitely takes money from somebody. He strikes me as a pretty independent thinker. There are other guys that might be a little more swamp creature-y, that it maybe is a little bit more quid pro quo. This is something I would say also that, like, basically every Western democracy has to figure out in the modern times. Is like,
well, I think the donation is significantly less, though, in other countries. It's particularly an American problem. Hundreds of millions to politicians and political parties. I mean, from somebody who sits outside of America, this seems like clear cases of bribery and corruption where you literally can't take that much. In fact, Tony Blair taking $1 million from a smoking company in New Labour in the 90s was seen as an absolute, was a huge controversy. And yet American politicians take hundreds of millions. Can you see how...
There's gross in ways these things happen. Hunter Biden was selling his paintings for like 50 grand a pop. No one was buying his crappy paintings for 50 grand a pop because they thought he was a good artist. They were buying access to his father, right? Like there's a million other ways you can do this. You can go, you know, you can write a book where you get a massive advance and then you can give all these speeches and you can go to Qatar and make a ton of money. Like, again, this is why I think the DOGE thing has been so good. We're finally just looking under the hood and realizing how misappropriated our tax dollars have been spent. And I think you can definitely connect that to lobbying and everything else. If there was some way, I actually do think within the next maybe 4 years in America, there's somehow going to be a much better, more transparent way of running campaigns. The idea that Kamala Harris spent, what was it like? I think it might have been $2 billion on that ridiculous campaign is completely, completely insane. The internet is freeing this. You don't have to spend as much as on ads and a whole bunch more. So I think a lot of this stuff is changing. But if the basic question is, are politics, is it a nasty game that people are corrupt? Like, yeah, obviously.
Yeah, no, fair enough. And that was kind of what I think Ollie and I were trying to get at, is maybe countries like the UK have certain legislation, some legislation in place, right, to protect that from happening and make sure that things are more transparent. So we also appreciate that you're open about the fact that things might change. And I think our viewers will appreciate that as well. Maybe to move it now to something a bit more specific, the deportations recently that have been going on. I think, first of all, just to kind of let our audience know your views on it, how do you feel about the recent mistakes that have happened with the deportations? I believe it was one or two people being deported. I believe it was one or two people being deported, who were being taken to be deported who shouldn't have been.
Can you give me an example of one, like a name, location, something?
Yeah, so just from the top of my head, I wouldn't be able to give it to you right now, but I think you know what I'm referring to.
Well, you wouldn't know. We're asking you the question, but you're not sure who you're referring to or the event. I would say broadly, I think this is part of like why people need to really source things. But I would say that I have no problem with the deportations virtually at any
level, we are mostly deporting criminals and drug dealers and gang members. We're sending them to El Salvadorian prisons, which is good for El Salvador, as Bukele has pointed out. Not everyone, you know, look, if you're here in America illegally, you've already broke the law. That seems to confuse a lot of people. But if you are an illegal immigrant in my country or an illegal immigrant in your country, you are a criminal. That is true. Now, we can talk about the different layers you want to associate with that. Is there a difference between someone who comes here from a gang, a Venezuelan gang, let's say, or MS-13, or that's here to sell fentanyl? Is there a difference between that guy and, say, a woman who came here from Mexico 50 years ago, who's now a grandmother, who her children are part of the community and go to school and everything else? There's obviously a difference in those two cases, but are they both illegal? They are both illegal. That's just a tough reality. So I do not have a problem going after every single, in this case, what we've been going after are the real criminals as it relates to all of this. But by the way, we have about, the numbers are a little unclear. It sounds like we have about 12 million illegals that were already here, probably even before the horrible 4 years of Biden letting everybody in. What do you do about that? That's the question that really needs to be named right now. But as far as I know, there was one case where the Democrats were claiming that some guy that got caught up in this wasn't a Venezuelan gang member. That might be the one you're talking about.
Yeah, it turns out.
And it turns out
again. No, okay.
It turns out that he was. But look, I would also say that when you're doing a lot of things, which the Trump administration is doing a lot of things at once, is it possible every now and again there's going to be a mistake? Yes, there is no perfect system. We don't pretend there's a perfect system. So I just, he came in promising to get rid of people, and that's what he's doing.
So would you be okay with, just hypothetically, if Trump took 1,000 criminals and there's, let's say, an 80% chance that one of them's innocent, and he said, okay, we're going to, we'll do capital punishment on all these people, but there's a chance that one of them is innocent. Would you take that risk? I think that's a fair question. And you can disagree, but I think that's a fair question.
I don't think it's an unfair question. Again, I mean, I think I already answered that. Like every now and then, hold on, let me answer. Every now and again, someone is going to get caught up in some of these things. So if you arrest 1,000 people, is it possible that 999 of them absolutely are guilty and there's some confusion around one of them and someone gets caught up? Yeah, but also, we're not putting these people to death. Right now, a lot of them we're sending out of the country. So you also brought capital punishment in there, which is a separate issue altogether.
As a thought experiment, would you apply the same logic? Was rather my question.
Yes. If understanding that there are no perfect systems, you have to make laws and rules. You have to apply them, and you hopefully apply them to the best of your ability. Within understanding that, is it possible that one out of 1,000 people could get caught up in this and that's a problem? Yeah, of course that's true. Of course, there's no perfect system. And generally, liberty-minded people don't pretend there's a perfect system. It's usually people on the left that think if you just give the system enough power, the system will be benevolent and perfect for everybody. So I would say it's a risk you have to take. If you are going to deport people, if you would like your country to remain British, which likely it will not be in any way that we can sort of convey what Britishness means in 20 years, you're going to have to deport people.
Okay, let's talk specifically about how it's being done then, because despite the possibility of mistake, things have to be done in the right way. Now, speaking about the sort of Venezuelan gangs that you mentioned, the method by which they were deported, which brought up a lot of controversy with regards to the attempt to block that or suspend that, at least for the time being, by a certain judge. The attempt to do that without due process, and this is legal fact, relied upon the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. So to give our viewers, I'm sure you know it, Dave, but to give our viewers an idea of that, that is supposed to be only invoked in periods of war where the people concerned come from a country actively at war at the US. Now, the US tried to deport circa 200 people. They did so. Those were primarily Venezuelan. Yet the Venezuelan president, Maduro, agreed to take those gangs, right? The president, the head of state. So Venezuela is clearly not at war with the US. And yet the act being invoked in order to deport these people without due process relies on the US being at war with that country. So for me, there's a clear case of disingenuousness there and misuse of law. Well, what's your opinion on that?
So, well, the administration's argument is that we are at some level of war with these gangs. No one's arguing that we're at war with
the law. The law is at war with the country. The law requires you be at war with the country.
Yeah, look, I believe in due process, absolutely. I don't necessarily believe that illegals here deserve the exact same due process that everyone else does. If we allowed for every time we get an illegal here who we know is a gang member and maybe brought in fentanyl or raped a woman or something else, and then we had to get that hung up in courts constantly, nothing would ever happen. That's just reality. So I suspect that this issue about the war power or the alien, what, sorry, what's it called? Not the War Powers Act.
The Alien Enemies Act.
I suspect that some of this will get caught up in courts over the terminology of technically, are you at war? You know, the president's allowed.
Would you say that America's at war with Venezuela? I think it's more than a technicality. Would you kind of concede that?
Well, I just said America's not at war with Venezuela, but I think you absolutely can argue that we are at, look, at some point, if China just keeps sending people through Mexico with fentanyl to kill our kids, whether we declare war or not, we are at war. So there's a difference between sort of like the actual declarative statement of what a war is, and then there's also every country's right to defend its sovereign borders.
But you agree that when we're interpreting law, and we should do so strictly, even if we're trying to get things done, we can't take a metaphorical interpretation of what is war, of what war is, right? Americans have to be at war with Venezuela in order for that to be legal on the basis of a law passed all the way back in 1798. So you can say, for a law, a general way, that would make it illegal. Right.
I'm not a big fan of just saying, oh my God, something was passed a long time ago, so it's somehow inherently bad.
Well, I mean, it's, you, yeah. You respect.
The Constitution was ratified a long time ago. The Declaration came a long time ago. You guys,
you're saying the standards of law in the US, right?
Et cetera, et cetera. Look, we can whittle the argument down to, okay, is there a way to sort of declare war against a terrorist organization or a gang or a bunch of fentanyl dealers? And how do we whittle that away from the war of a country? I haven't heard anyone, including anyone in the administration, saying we're at war with Venezuela. What I know is that Donald Trump ran on, we are going to get the drug dealers and the rapists and criminals off the street. And that's exactly what he's doing, which is why most Americans are completely for this. If tomorrow they were just showing up at random Walmarts to grab grandma out of nowhere, that would be a problem, obviously. But doing what they're doing right now, there was no other way. There was literally no other way.
Right, well, look, but the judge actually who tried to block this only wanted to suspend it to make sure, and this is usually a process, particularly on such high profile cases that would have only taken a few days. In fact, the order was gonna come through the next day. The order was gonna come through the next day to review that, right? So the judge that blocked that was only wanting to check through proper legal due process that the Alien Enemies Act was legitimate in that regard. Now, the fact that you, who's an expert on this matter, aren't actually entirely aware of the specific conditions of the law or exactly what it's called, to me demonstrate that to some extent there's a disregard for the state of law and the due process.
Well, you're framing that question in like a absurdly obnoxious way. I didn't sit here pretending that I'm a lawyer. I'm telling you what my opinions are on the matter. Also, as
sure,
it pertains to
the political commentator, right?
As it pertains to the flight, apparently the flight was already over international waters. And even that aside, the broader issue, if you want to talk about sort of the struggle as it pertains to the legal issues at the moment, the real issue is that right now the problem that we're having in America is, can any lower level judge decide that he can overrule the president? That's what the real struggle in our separation of powers is about right now. Trump is doing some things. If he did something that is truly illegal, that has to basically get up to the Supreme Court and they can stop him from doing it, right? That's the judicial branch saying that the executive branch is doing something illegal. What seems to be happening across the board right now is that lower level circuit judges, random judges that you've never heard of, are basically saying, I'm more powerful than the presidency. That is the judicial I would say, crisis or tension that we're dealing with right now.
That is kind of the point, though, of the checks and the balances and the judicial powers, is that things cannot just kind of get pushed through because someone said they're going to be pushed through. They need to go through certain checks. And as I think Ollie demonstrated, there is clearly some debate about whether or not this is against the law.
Again, there is some debate as to whether these lower level judges have the authority to do it. I've talked to several lawyers. You could watch my show with Josh Hammer, who's one of the chief editors at Newsweek, who's also a lawyer, a couple weeks ago, talking about why these lower level judges don't actually have the jurisdiction. Again, as I just said, that would be different than the Supreme Court saying that these were illegal actions. Because otherwise, think about it, the president, who, you know, however many people, 60 million people voted into office, the president would be quite literally unable to do anything if every decision that he made was subject to a lower level, some random lower level judge. You would just get activist judges that could basically stop everything. That would be a far bigger, I would say, constitutional crisis than what we're dealing with now. If the lower court judge is making a let's say a cogent argument and that works its way up to the Supreme Court and they make a ruling on it and then the president goes against that, then we have a bigger problem. But just handing everything to some random lower court judge, I think most people realize, boy, you can't just make that person more powerful than the will of the people.
Would you characterize the judge involved, Judge James Boasberg, as, let's say, an activist judge who's doing this for political reasons?
I don't know enough about him personally, but I would say the actions would lend themselves to believing that, yes.
Since you're being honest about not being so certain about the specifics, I won't push you too hard there. I was going to suggest examples from Trump's previous administration where he actually ruled in favor of Trump. But in that case, let's move on to discussing executive orders and Trump's use of them. What do you see as the function of executive orders with regards to the separation of powers between the executive, the judicial, and the legislative?
Yeah.
And when should they be employed?
Yeah, if we do a quick civics 101, we have three branches of government. The legislature writes the laws. The president's supposed to sign them into law. The judicial makes sure that they're legal. That's the basic idea of three branches of government and checks and balances, right? You can go back for however long I've been on Twitter, probably 12 years, if not more. It feels like a lifetime. And, you know, largely I'm very against executive actions. And I would say, very vocal about that for many, many years. And then what happens is, presidents do them. That's just how it's done. So Trump came in. I mean, we don't even have to go to Obama or Bush before him. They all do tons of them. But if you remember, Trump came in, did a bunch of executive actions as it pertained to the border. It did largely close our border. Then he tried to get a bipartisan border deal passed. The Democrats wouldn't work with him on that. Chuck Schumer made it very clear, we're not going to give this guy literally an inch of wall or anything else. So he did a bunch of things that, you know, largely stopped some level of illegal immigration into the country. And then the day Joe Biden became president, he reversed, I think it was 67, I have no doubt that you guys will fact check me, executive actions on the border. And then we had 4 years of an open border where thousands and thousands, well, literally millions of people came in, and we have no idea where they are or what their intentions are or anything else. Then Trump comes in just 2 months ago, and he puts all of those orders back and adds a couple more. The problem with legislating like that or being governed like that is, A, it's not how we're supposed to be governed, right? Most of the laws are supposed to be written by the Congress and then ratified by the president. That's how it's supposed to be. But sort of putting aside like the technical part, the bigger issue there is that if we do this, if we just decide to outsource everything to the president, and the president can do anything by a pen, and also the next president can reverse everything by a pen, we're going to end up in just some like endless, you know, psychological tennis match, just constantly doing this forever. So what I would love to see, and Trump's got a lot on his plate right now, and they're doing an awful lot, so I don't know that this is happening right now. He's done a lot by executive action. Again, I don't love it philosophically. I didn't love it when Biden was doing it. I didn't love it when Obama was doing it, or George Bush before him. But this is how they do it. So putting aside whether we like it or not, this is how it's being done. What I would love to see Trump do is start actually trying to get some of these things passed in the proper channels. So go to the House, talk to the congressmen, talk to the senators, and try to get some bills passed. Unfortunately, Congress, if you think the presidency and executive actions are kind of like abused and corrupt or something like that, I mean, Congress and the Senate is significantly worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for being honest and highlighting elements where you maybe divert from the Trump administration and you think that perhaps philosophically it's best not to. So if you were speaking to Trump, would you recommend that he use less executive orders, given that even though it's also been done by Democrats and people you disagree with more, from a point of view of democratic process, it's problematic, at least to some degree?
Yeah, I mean, I think I basically just answered that. If I was sitting with him right now, I would probably say to him something that I've consistently said on my show, which he has to do an awful lot really fast right now. That's what he has to do. You know, you can feel, just going off the topic that we discussed previously, if he tries to do something on the border and a lower level judge can reverse him, he's got to move quick. If he tries to, let's say, stop federal funding for states that want boys and girls sports, and then a judge goes after him, he has to move quick. So I think partly, and this is just what politics is, this is how old are you guys? Early 20s, probably?
Yeah, 20, 21, 22.
Right, 22. So this is not being a 20-year-old reading Ayn Rand for the first time. I don't mean that offensively, but what I mean is this is not, I don't mean this purely in the most like philosophic sense. There's philosophy and that's very important. And then there's real politics. Like, how do you actually get things done? And what you try to do as a good human being, I think, is take the best of your principles and then apply to them in your politics in a way that doesn't shred those principles. But politics is a very nasty game. So if I was sitting here with Trump, I would tell him, look, I'm not that thrilled with doing everything by executive action, but I understand why you got to move quick. They're already prepping for the midterm elections. And if the Republicans lose the House, well, he's lost that. And then he's a 4-year president. That's it. So he will be lame duck in about 18 months, in essence. That's bad news. So he has to do things fast right now. That's just real politic versus the question that you're asking me, which is just purely philosophically, would I prefer that there were virtually no executive actions and it was only done in like the most severe emergency case? Sure.
Fair enough. I think there may be a lot larger gradient between kind of Bismarckian realpolitik and, let's say, idealist philosophy. But in any case, I'm glad that we could also find some common ground between ourselves. And I know the interview kind of got heated at points, but I think that's what times like this call for, is really heated discussions about these sort of issues. I think a really nice place to kind of bring this to an end and maybe kind of solidify that common ground is, what's something that you agree with on the left side of things? On the, let's say, the far woke mob, as maybe the right.
Well, I don't know that I do my character out here, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I agree with anything.
So nothing at all.
Well, on the
maybe the value
on the far left side, I don't think I agree with anything. You know, I would say maybe the best version of this that I could give you is that it's nice to have empathy. It is good to have empathy for your fellow man. It's an important part of being a human. It's something that separates us from the animals, right? It really is. We don't just live on our instincts. It's important to have that, to see yourself in your fellow man and be neighborly in those things. I think, unfortunately, what has happened with a lot of the lefties and a lot of the woke types is that they have what my friend Gad Saad calls suicidal empathy. So they put empathy at the top of their hierarchy of needs. And when you put empathy above everything else, you will basically bury your head in the sand to all of the bad things. And that just means that you're going to get beheaded a little bit lower on the neck. So I think empathy is good, but suicidal empathy is not. I would also say that if you framed it a little bit differently, and if it was, well, what would be an old liberal principle? Like, the thing is, I believe in the same exact liberal principles I've always believed. They just have nothing to do with the modern Democrat Party. They have nothing to do with AOC. They have nothing to do with Bernie Sanders or any of these people. If the liberals had been able to defend liberalism, there's a chance that I would still be a Democrat right now. Unfortunately, they've been unable to do that. But I guess the best way to end it would be, because I think you guys saw the Piers thing, is
I actually love talking to people who I disagree with. I prefer it than people that I agree with because that's easy and I can do that at dinner with my friends. And sometimes I disagree with my friends too. What I think unfortunately has happened is a huge swath of the left has become so intolerant in the name of tolerance that all they do is yell and insult you and lie and the rest of it. A huge, huge swath. Of course, I'm not saying everybody, but even Piers, when I had him on my show, admitted that it is way easier for him to get people on the right who he disagrees with about a bunch of different things, because he's kind of old school liberal too, but that people on the right broadly will explain their ideas, they'll calmly lay it out, they don't insult you. I mean, you referenced that interview I did with Cenk, like, after he insulted me 20 times, I probably called him a fat cow or something, but that's a fact. But you get it.
Yeah.
You get it. Like, I went into that interview like, hey, I'll talk about my stuff. He went in a typical leftist fashion, which is, you know, I'm a bull in a china shop and I'm going to ruin everything. So for whatever, I assume your audience leans a little left, that would be what I would glean from this. I would say if they're looking inward a little bit and trying to figure out, well, how do we not just say we're the good guys, but act like the good guys? I would say it's probably with a little more actual empathy as opposed to faux empathy.
Okay, thank you. Let's, if you don't mind, we'll fire that back just for the sake of being open-minded. What are one or two things which you think are significantly wrong with the overriding discourse on the right or the way that the right are doing things?
That's interesting. It's a little harder because the right generally, especially now, is simply not as monolithic as the left. I mean, if you look at the MAGA movement, you know, you have like your sort of more traditional religious conservatives, for sure. You have like the most Trumpian sort of America First people. You have this new swath of people that are the ex-libs. That's a pretty freaking wide tent. I would say that there is some little, like, it feels like an X thing mostly, like a little bit of identity politics growing on the right that I'm a bit concerned about that I think is worth noting.
Would you be more specific, if you don't mind? Can you be more specific?
Well, there's just like a certain set of people that no matter what happens, it's basically, oh, the Jews. Like, I think that there's like some, which is ironically, I mean, that's the horseshoe theory, right? Like, that's the, if you take identity politics to its end game, you're going to basically end up on the same spot, whether you're right or left. And at the end of most conspiracy theories, which unfortunately are just conspiracy theories, the easiest thing to do is be like, ah, it's the Jews. But I would say the discourse on the right is just much more pleasant. It really is. And in some ways, that's why I evolved the way I did, because when I was on the left and I started just talking about this stuff a little more openly, I would talk to all of these people that Cenk and some of these other people told me were the horrible racist people, you know, Glenn Beck and Larry Elder and Jordan Peterson and Ben Shapiro and Dennis Prager. And then I'd sit down with them and I'd be like, boy, you know, I disagree with them on the death penalty or abortion, some of them even on gay marriage, important things, but they were nice and they were generous of spirit and kind and everything else. And I get virtually none of that from anyone on the left. So it's not exactly like the asymmetry there is a little strange.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks for joining us for this interview. Do you have any closing thoughts for our audience?
Are you guys in Oxford?
Right now we're in London, but I just graduated from Oxford University and Ollie's going to do his final exams in about 2 months.
There's no need to talk about it, but yeah, they're coming up soon.
Very nice, very nice. Well, I just did an Oxford Union debate. It was my second time speaking at Oxford. I had spoken at Oxford about 5 years ago, but that wasn't a debate, just a talk that I gave. And then we actually turned it into a kind of lively debate with the students. But I just did my Oxford debate about a month ago. It should be up on YouTube anytime soon. It was should we cancel culture? And I'm happy to say that I took the free speech side and I did win at Oxford. So that was nice.
Nice. Well, Dave Rubin, thanks for joining us today. This has been Critical Edge.
My pleasure, guys.